Phronesis. Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.
Hello, I am Scott Allen, and thanks to my daughter Kate for developing the intro to the Practical Wisdom for Leaders podcast, where we offer a smart, fast-paced discussion on all things leadership. My guests help us explore timely topics and incorporate practical tips to help you make a difference in how you lead and live. If you haven't done so, please click subscribe so you automatically, seamlessly stay in the know when we publish new episodes. Likewise, please provide me with feedback. What do you like? What do you dislike? And what else would you like to know? And now, today's show.
Today on the program, we have Axel Meyerhofer. And Axel is actually a colleague of mine. We actually did our PhDs at the same institution, Antioch University. And he brings, I was just saying to him before we started recording today, he brings this really, really incredible perspective that I don't think a lot of people have, which is this gentleman has a PhD in leadership, but he's also the CEO of an organization. He's leading. He's actively doing so every day. So I think the conversation today is going to be a really fun conversation because we're going to have the opportunity to explore this intersection between theory and practice and see what that looks like in real life. So Axel, thank you for being with us and maybe tell our listeners a little bit about you, sir.
Yeah, hi, Scott, and thanks for having me. A little bit about me. I always start out by saying the accent that you're probably detecting is from Germany. I tried for a while to get rid of it, never really got, so it's still there. It's probably always going to be there. Have been living in the US now for 25 years, and as you said, did my PhD at Antioch University. I originally came over to the U.S. with the military. I was an aviator in the German Air Force and then had the really amazing privilege to be allowed to exchange with a U.S. Air Force officer, basically take on his job as an assistant director of operations for a fighter wing. He took on my job as the assistant director for a flight school. And for a couple of years, we basically did each other's job. And then I got into program management because the governments wanted to build a big flight training center in New Mexico. And so this whole thing became much longer than I ever anticipated. We got used to nice weather. My daughter went to school in the US and everything. And so then we were looking, is there a way to actually stay instead of keeping this within the military frame? And maybe as a little side note, in fighter aviation, your body can only allow you to do this for so long. So I was getting to the point where that was coming to an end. And the question was, and I'm always joking, they call that in the Air Force, do you want to fly a desk or do you want to get out? Now, the joke on that is, I decided I wanted to get out because I had that delusional idea that I wouldn't want to fly a desk. And for the last, like, almost 20 years, 15 years now, I've been flying a desk, basically, right? The difference, although I have to say, since you asked me about PhD and leadership and stuff, there's a difference when you fly other people's desk versus your own desk, right? Like, so when you say, this is where we're going. So that makes a big difference. But as far as finishing that little episode, got out of the military, was immediately sponsored by a software company because they were interested in my relationships with institutions and government in Europe. So they sponsored me to help them to get into that market, and that worked out. And then in 2005, I started my own business and ever since have been in it. And here we are. And Scott, Ellen, and Axel are sitting and doing a podcast.
Yes. Well, so tell me about the business. What are you building?
Well, the business started out and is still mainly operating as a consulting company. And recently I added a component, an educational component about investing for passive income. It started out for me mainly because I realized early on, coming from a military background and coming from Germany, it is very, very common for your listeners who don't know this necessarily for Europe, that everybody pretty much always has a mindset that there is some system set up that prepares all your work life for retirement. Whether in the military you get a pension, or if you're working for a company, they have company pension and retirement programs and all kinds of things. And even though we have the 401k, to me, for one, you can't really do it when you start a small business, but also it is really something that is not really available to you until you maybe 63, 65, 67, and some people say in the future it's going to be in the 70s. So I looked into it and found out there wasn't really anything and started investing in real estate. And as I kept progressing in this to really build a passive income, and I saw and listened to a couple of your shows, somebody was talking about their leadership legacy as a CEO. For me, there is also a legacy in the context of how do I provide for the rest of my life or my family, and ultimately hand in turn over what we built to my daughter. And so that became important. And this second branch in the business is basically by the urging of a lot of friends to have something official where I help other people build passive income through real estate investing.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Multifaceted here, Axel, from a fighter pilot to an investment, a real estate titan, we'll call you, sir.
Oh, yeah, that's too much.
To an educator. I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, what's exciting for me to learn about is, again, there's very few people probably in the globe that have a PhD in leadership and are actively leading an organization. And so as you reflect on that reality, are there some things that stand out for you? What are some of the gaps potentially in the theory? Where has the theory helped you? I'm really interested in knowing a little bit more about your perspectives from that vantage point.
Yeah, thank you, Scott. Well, I would say there are a couple of facets to consider. So one of the things that I have seen is really the size of the organization. And we just touched on the fact that I was in the military. That's probably in most cases the largest kind of organization you can be in, even if you compare it to regular companies. But I have still and had the pleasure to work for really large companies in a consultative role, like Bayer, Roche, Genentech, Ball Corporation, Eaton. Those are really, really large, like up to 100,000 people, engineering firms and stuff. Some of the better known names, some in the San Francisco Bay Area. And then in comparison to that, we have also clients that are much, much smaller, sometimes even still in a startup role. And then my own company that I is a 15-year startup, so to speak. it's constantly evolving, but there has never been an intention to really make it big. And one of the things, for example, to answer your question is, and I can imagine that this could be interesting for your audience, is to really ask yourself, for yourself, if you are in a business, is this business really a business in the sense where we're trying to get to scale, where we're trying as the leaders and maybe executives to get to a point where the business is so well developed, the systems are so well developed, the growth has been allowing us to go through some of these phases of organizational development, that we can really say, if I were to step out tomorrow, everything is there that somebody else can step in, or it can even run by itself for a while. And that would be for me now, after a while, the definition of a business. And in comparison, and I think there are way more out there than anybody is willing to accept, is a practice.
Yeah.
And so I would actually, when people ask me and don't have the background like you or don't necessarily have been dabbling in this for a while, but for those a little bit more informed, where you don't have to go into lengthy explanations, I always say what I really have, even though on legal grounds and otherwise it is a business, tax-wise and so forth. But in reality, the way it's operating is really a practice, right? And the difference being, in a nutshell, I have tried, by the way, really hard to get clients to accept, to say, hey, I know Scott, and Scott is an awesome guy, and he has a PhD, and he knows everything better than me, and he's younger than me, and he looks better than me. You should actually allow me to put him in this project. And over and over and over, it's kind of like this dentist thing when you say, well, I have a young colleague, he's even better than me. You say, no, man, you do my two, so I'm leaving, right? And that's kind of like the situation I've been running in. And for me, those are some of the indications of you really have a practice, which is then also an issue when you ask yourself, could it ever be sold? If it is very tightly connected to what you're offering, your philosophy, the things that you have developed, the things that you have wrote and written, and being on podcasts and all that kind of stuff. So that's one part, the size. That then also directly connects to impact, right? So when you ask, well, how does that relate to the studies in at the university, I have the only reason really I would have to say why I went beyond the graduate degree and into the leadership PhD was it's basically all John Cotter's fault in a way, because I got hooked on leading change. And then it's kind of like a little bit of a funny story in a way, because I, through a couple of different weird connections, know Holger Rathgeber. And that name may only make sense or be known to a couple of people. But John Cotter started out, I think it was 95 or something like, to write a pretty seminal book called Leading Change. But it's it's a organizational consultant at the School of Business at Harvard writing a book. That's kind of the book, right? I mean, the book is great. But
and then
in German,
the and...
In German, we call that Dröge, which means like you kind of have to be careful not to fall asleep when you're reading it. And that's no ding on John. The 8 steps of organizational change are fine, but, you know, it's just the style. And Holger took it upon himself to say, you know, I think this is really important, but we need to make it more accessible. And do you mind if I tell the story, Ricky?
Please.
So the story is basically, so Holger reads Leading Change, looks at it, thinks at it, and said, man, that should be really accessible. That could be a great program for teaching people in workshops. Now, think about it. This was around 2000, right? So he writes a letter to John Cotter and says, hey, John, I wrote a fable that supports your book. I'm not expecting that you do anything with it, but I think this could help. And he told me, to his absolute amazement, John Cotter took it up and said, wow, what a great idea. Let's collaborate. And for anybody who is maybe a little more recent in leadership studies has maybe heard about the book Our Iceberg is Melting.
Yes.
And when you look at that little book that says Our Iceberg is Melting, it literally John went as far as putting Holger on the cover. Right, so which is kind of cool. So, but what I'm getting at is, so you have this, for example, as one of the theorems or one of the starting points to say, okay, when I think about leadership, it's basically a continuous change process. Now, I mean, look at what happened in 2020 and still ongoing. That is probably the epitome of massive, rapid, sudden, unexpected change happening. So change is a big theme in leadership, but when you bring it back to, okay, in my, for example, parts of my business as the leader, and the business in, like I explained earlier, being more like a practice, I have really very direct impact. When a client, on the other hand, like one of these large clients like a Bayer or a Genentech says, can you help us? Even in a somewhat leading role where they say, okay, we have this project, we know you have gained a lot of experience in the pharmaceutical industry over the last 10 or 15 years. And that particular perspective of how to get something timely bound to get done in the fashion that the company needs to get to the next level is a time-limited thing. But I believe there aren't that many people who get in from the outside, very quickly ramp up, speak the language, help the company. But to really make an impact and a change, even if you have those theories from the PhD program or graduate program in the background, is way, way harder than on a smaller scale, because you're running into all kinds of existing systems, existing philosophies, certain ways of how the company has decided to organize itself. And what I'm detecting now, if you say, okay, well, where is the PhD itself helpful, is I think what we both learned, or anybody who goes to something like that, is to really become familiar with studying and being able to do comparative analysis to say, what have I seen? How is human behavior, for example, informed by the organization's culture and processes and stuff like that? And one of the things, one of the themes that I have found is mindset and contracts. And those things really don't go together in that way. But mindset has more to do with the human behavior. And it went as far as me writing a mindset manual for our real estate investing educational program that is not really about investing. It's like literally about the term mindset. But then on the other hand, to the organizational component, where contracts are so important, and maybe I'm more exposed to them due to the work that I do than other people, but contracts are very important. And one of the things, anybody who has ever signed a contract for anything knows that after you signed it, and then something happens where you really have to go back and say, okay, what was really the paragraph that was written here? And you find out, oh, I didn't really, and I'm not talking fine print, right? I'm talking the official part. And you realize, wow, this is either way too high level, it doesn't really address the details, or it's missing really important components, and then you want to go and change it? And not because you are on one side and you say, hey, we, the other side who may have made the proposal forgot something and you want to get it in now. It's not even that they don't agree that there could be some better language. But the problem that if you have agreements, and nowadays we're getting more and more in a work environment where we're not necessarily sitting next to each other or coming into each other's buildings. So it's all virtual, right? And with that, you now get in the situation that you kind of ultimately have to fall back on what did you really agree to? And I'm finding when you have larger organizations, you have this really detriment that the people who negotiate contracts or the people that are involved on the legal side are not really subject matter experts. And so you end up with legally absolutely sound and content-wise oftentimes lacking contracts, which leads to enormous churn and enormous frustration. And when there are any additional things, like some little pandemic happening or not being able to go to work anymore or stuff like that, then people are much more affected by things where you would normally say, couldn't we have just settled this and then go and do our thing? Well, but if the foundation is not solid, from which you thought you could actually do your thing, everything gets much harder to do. And to identify those things, that's where I would say the PhD, the having learned how to study, having learned how to do comparative analysis, having I feel super blessed that so many different companies, big and small, have invited me to help them. Because through that breath, you can then see, okay, these guys do it this way, these guys do it that way, and you can pull out all the good things. And I'm always trying to, on the one hand, improve myself, but I'm also trying to convey, hey, I've seen this. Have you considered this? Would this be something that we could maybe introduce here? And I can already almost predict if we do A, B will happen, right? Because I've seen it often enough.
There's a lot in there. My mind is swimming right now. So it really is. I mean, I love it. I love it. When you are speaking, when we get to this theory to practice whole conversation, I always think of, and as a military man, this may resonate for you. There was a Prussian general, kind of a famous quote, and the quote was, no battle plan ever survives contact with the enemy.
Absolutely. I can give you a practical about that. When I came over here, right, just as a quick little anecdote. So I come over here from Germany, and I'm joining this fighter wing, and most of them within the last 12 months had come back from the Iraq war, where they were literally deployed with their unit and had been flying F-111s in the war. And so I was super interested, for one, because I had never flown together with a U.S. military unit in wartime. I heard them on the radio and stuff like that, and we went on U.S. tankers and stuff, but you never really gotten together. So I said, how was that? But especially, and this goes back why this is potentially relevant to leadership, is the U.S. operates different than Germany. In Germany, you do what's called goal orientation. So the directive is, here is a goal, and you, as the whatever level of leadership you are asked to achieve that goal. And you use your experience and the rules naturally as well, but mainly your experience, and find a way to achieve that goal. In the U.S. system, it's what it's called command and control. So there's literally bookshelves and bookshelves full of binders of describing every eventuality that could happen. And I was always fascinated, how do you do this in combat where what you just said applies, right? The best plan is basically obsolete the day or the minute the first bullet is shot. And it literally, when you said that, it immediately came back to my mind that the guys at the bar in the squadron, right, they said, oh, the books went out the way when we landed. Most of them we didn't even take along, you know. So that doesn't mean that they just flew all over the place and did whatever they wanted to, but it was completely impractical to try to remember what rule under which condition is the right one to apply, because by the time that you figure that out, even if you're super smart, keep in mind, in this kind of flying, you're moving 10 miles a minute.
Yeah.
Right? So if you're living away from anywhere, if you just imagine this for a second, right? If how far is something 10 miles away? Imagine you're there in 1 minute, 60 seconds, right? So so if stuff works and moves that fast, there's no way that you can, in your mind, go through an encyclopedia of regulations to figure out what to do. You can do a lot of things with training, but what I'm getting at is, right, the books literally flew out the window.
Exactly. But I think that you said a few things that really stand out for me. I think that that training and that scenario planning prepares the mind. And in some ways, it teaches the individual how to study, how to read a situation. I think in the military, it's called the OODA loop. But it teaches you how, and some foundations. And there's a like I said, a foundation that's there, that exists. But just like in business, as soon as we make contact, as soon as our strategy makes contact with the outside world and COVID occurs, or digital disruption is all around us, or any number of other factors, as you know, that have impacted real estate in recent years, it's your experience, it's that foundation, but then also your experience like you were speaking of.
Yeah, the one thing I would like to add on that, I totally agree with you, Scott. The part is, you really want to be very cognizant, what are you training? If you're training the ability to recall things that are written down somewhere and you have so much internalized them that you have them available very quickly, that's one thing to train. The other thing which I have become more fond of training is train yourself to be able to analyze a situation really quickly. And then between what you know from learning this stuff that's in the books and combining it with your experience, come up with a doable solution that has the best merit of success. And that's a little bit of a different kind of training than purely focusing on this, can I recall what is the right thing to do because it's written somewhere?
Well, it makes me think of, I'm excited, I think probably my 50th episode, I'm going to have these two authors, Snowden and Boone, on. And they wrote an article in Harvard Business Review. And it's a really powerful article. It's about decision-making and leadership. But they start to unpack, well, if we're making decisions and it's a simple problem versus a complicated problem versus a complex problem versus a chaotic problem, well, there's a lot of different skills that are involved. And I love how they're thinking about that, because you're exactly right. I mean, it is so critical. What you're training is important. And I think leadership still, we struggle with that sometimes. I don't know that we have those levels of leader development that are required, so that we're training people at these different levels to be thinking that way.
Yeah.
And I loved what you said about mindset, because Carol Dweck, her work has been foundational in how I parent, how I teach, how I even, you know, really conduct my life. Would you talk a little bit more about mindset and how that informs your work?
Yeah, I love Carol's work, and I always try to be in growth mindset. You know, like she describes it with the different brains, left and right side and stuff like that. Yeah. I actually adopted for the mindset manual, and if anybody wants to have it, it's at ideawealthgoer.com, and you can just download it there for free. But what we looked in at that when I wrote that was to say, okay, what is common? What have I experienced oftentimes? And yes, it's a little bit tilted to this in investing side, but it's just as true in a lot of my projects, is you find people, if I had to categorize and only had two choices like Carol did, I would say you have people in a victim mindset and you have people in a creative or creator mindset. And for me, part of the goal is to say, if you want to accomplish anything, and I don't mean creator in the sense of creative, even though that can be a component, but creator in the sense of I want to do something. I'm setting a goal. I'm going to find the energy to go after something, rather than I'm the victim, the environment, my employer, the healthcare situation, the government, and you can keep adding to the list. There's tons and tons of things. Some people call it excuses, but it becomes more of than an excuse when it really impacts you to a point that it paralyzes you. right? Yeah. Versus yeah. when you're in a creator mindset, then you basically identify, and I combine this with my coaching methodology. I call that grower. It comes from John Whitmore's original and very famous in business coaching grow model. And just for your audience, real quick, the reason that I expanded on it is because grow itself, and I'm not saying it as an excuse, it's a great model, I'm totally behind it, but grow is really only good for the very first session. Because if you think about it, it stands for you setting your goals, you're looking at what's your current reality, then you're looking at obstacles and opportunities, and then you decide what actions will I take.
Yeah.
Okay, so now you have that, and then what do you do when you come back for the next session 2 weeks later? If you and I were to do this, the first thing I would ask you, or if you were the coach or any in your audience is the coach, they would say, how did it go? Or what were your experiences? That's what the E that I added to it stands for. Let's talk about the experiences from the actions that you said you would take, right? And sometimes it's, I never knew how much this time it would take this time, so I'm embarrassed that I didn't take as much action as I thought I would. Well, let's talk about that. So that's experience, and then the second R stands for what were the results of your action? Because the question from that becomes, well, if I have any results, even small, do they change my goal? And that makes it really a cycle. That's why I call it grower. But the thing to bring this back to where you were saying, from a creator mindset, I need to be willing to say, okay, I know I want to accomplish something on whatever level and whatever scale, and whether it's inside your job or outside for your family, for yourself, for your retirement. And then to say, okay, what's in my way? So what are my obstacles? And what things can I do? Do I know somebody? Can I call Scott or Axel and say, hey, I'm facing this. Can you help me get around it, over it? How somehow can overcome this obstacle to get closer to my goal? And as soon as you get in that mindset, you're creating basically your future rather than sitting there and letting future happen to you, right?
I've said it one other time on this podcast, Axel, but I had a student during a reflection last fall say something, or they didn't say it, they wrote it, that was just beautiful. But we were exploring Elon Musk, and we were exploring Elon Musk's different adventures, right? I mean, he has so many different things going on. But the student wrote this, and it has just always stuck with me. It was one of those moments. But he said that in relation to our getting to Mars, he said Elon Musk has a mindset that a solution exists. So we might not have it yet. We might not know what it is. But it exists. It can be done. And when you have that mindset, it completely reframes what could be. And again, we might not have it right now, but an answer exists and we can solve it. We can get there. That's a really interesting mindset to have, right?
No, absolutely. I totally agree with that. I would love to do an episode with you on Elon Musk because I'm a huge fan, but I'm also kind of like a closet engineer, right? So from an aviation point of view, I love the Falcon 9 and the Starship development and stuff like that. From an environmentalist perspective, because, you know, both as a German, but also as a person, that's important to me, which, you know, you can argue if it's a car company or an energy company, but it's definitely good for the environment. And other things that have been done. For me, I would put more maybe a little bit of an academic view on it, if you connect it back to our leadership studies. And that is one of the fundamental things that he is preaching. And I don't know how many people actually go to that level of depth, is to find first principle solutions. Mm-hmm. Right. And so to what you said and what your student said, I would add, it's not just the belief that there is a solution out there. I would think there's also a strong conviction that the combination of four first principles that is possible, or the different combinations that are possible, haven't been tried.
Yeah.
Right? So when you look at NASA and the government spending $1 billion on a rocket that literally uses space shuttle engines from 1985, right now, and the goal is to get them to the moon by 2025 or 24.
Yeah.
And then you have another guy who says, you're basically regurgitating, almost like a cow, old stuff.
Yeah.
And you claim that the only first principles you have found by making this old stuff the first time is the only way to go. Why don't we try some other first principles in combination of them to see what else we can do and maybe find a better solution. And then you end up with Artemis is costing thousands of dollars per pound or kilogram to get into space. And Elon Musk is talking about $20 a kilogram or $20 a pound, where people say, well, that's a two or three orders of magnitude different. Well, if you combine the first principles in a different way, you get to different results. But again, you could almost say the one side is saying, I'm in this victim mentality. If anything goes wrong, I blew $1 billion, so I have to make sure everything is right. Or you can be in a creative environment where if you look at Starship testing, he says, I give it a 30% chance that it's going to go. It costs $10 million to put together. But on the scale that we're thinking, it's peanuts. It's the sand corn on the beach, and we need to try. And the more we try, the better we get. Iterative process, but with a clear goal in mind, right? So it applies this idea of whether you call it growth mindset or creative mindset. It keeps applying over and over again. And I really am a big advocate. And I hope that maybe some of the energy that I can bring across in an audio thing, I'm really trying to be an advocate for people to say, man, just don't be afraid. Give yourself a goal. Take some examples of people that are doing it already, either on a large scale, on a small scale, but make it personal to yourself and then go after it. And if you feel that you need re-encouragement, then get somebody like Scott or myself who can be your coach, your mentor, your cheerleader, your guide, whatever you call it. But somebody who says, hey, if you're down, I'm here for you. Let's talk about it and let's get going again.
Well, what else have you been thinking about recently, lately? It could be observations having to do with leadership, but it could be something else that's on the front burner for you right now.
Well, I mean, this is very off topic and normally not something that I like to talk about. But one thing that I found, especially when you're in kind of like a leadership or CEO and executive position, is I think it's really important to always trying to be kind of ahead of the game, right? If people say, what's the difference between leadership and management? For me, it's mainly looking in the future, coming up with suitable goals and suitable strategies, and then trying to communicate them in a way that motivates the people to come on the journey with you. Right. And when I'm looking at some of the things that I've seen happening, I mean, I've come here and stayed here because of all the things that I think make America awesome. And without going into the details, what I've seen in the last 20 years happening, and some people make it sound like it all happened yesterday or last week with the culmination of some ugly things. But I've seen a constant evolution of division and mind games and indoctrination and stuff like that going on. And what I'm really afraid about is that people have been, and I'm careful using this kind of language, but I believe people in large, large numbers have been, in a sense, reduced to survival mode, right? Really, if you go to Maslow's pyramid or hierarchy, to just be at the lowest level, we need food, we need shelter, we need somehow save our family and nothing beyond anymore, because we're constantly fighting just to survive. And a lot of the things that normally when you get to slightly higher levels, I'm not saying you need to get to self-actualization, but somewhere maybe on the mid-level, then you have the ability to make time to say, okay, how does our system work? How can like a guy like Elon Musk say, I want to save the world and go to Mars, or I want to save the environment? Even when you're a young person like Greta, right? Like Thunberg. Something like that. But if you constantly have to struggle for survival, those kind of things are not even on your radar. And I'm afraid that so large numbers of the population are in this kind of basic survival mode, while a tiny, I always say, like if you make a soup, on the top, if it's a good soup with bones and stuff like that, you have this thin little layer of fat. That's kind of the people that I feel right now have the ability to actually reflect and take time and think about the future and look at it from different ways. And then the whole mass, the whole 99 or 99.5% of the rest of the soup is just surviving, right? And if you are, and if the whole population is in this mode, things can happen and are happen, or kind of under this layer of fat are kind of bubbling. And every so often they break out like they did last week. But I'm really afraid that a really, really good idea and a really good system that was originally established, especially after World War II, is starting to fall apart because it loses its support, right? It's been so much put into you either on this side or you're on that side. You know, there is no, and this is kind of language is sometimes beautiful, right? We talk about common ground.
Yeah.
How do you stand on a trench is the question, right? If we have removed common ground and there's only one side and the other side, and we're talking about standing free floating, hovering in the middle of a trench, it doesn't work. Right. And that's my fear. That's what I'm seeing. And I'm really, really contemplating what am I going to have to do about it? I don't know that I have a solution, but there are so many really pretty ugly things happening that I've started to become afraid. Now, you have to keep in mind, I said when we started this that I'm originally from Germany. So I'm ultra aware of history, especially when it comes to German history. And I don't want to go there in our discussion, but people should really become aware. What are the signs when human behavior from a very survival type perspective starts taking on forms that we thought we had been extinguishing for decades because we offered more and more people a better life? And when we go back to survival mode, we're basically enabling these really instinctive kind of reactions rather than thoughtful reactions. And that's scaring me right now. Where is it going? And are we going to find a way to stop it? And part of it is good leadership. But then the question comes, you know, when you have a large behemoth like a 300 million people organization, how much impact has a leader versus a startup, right? And where we live is not a startup anymore. It's a 200-year-plus organization. And just by changing one person or a group of people, the question still remains, can we close the trench? Or is this kind of a forever thing now, right?
Well, Axel, I think you bring up something really wonderful. I've been reflecting a lot about this, a little bit on the podcast, but it like you, I don't have answers. I think you're exactly right. For me, I kind of don't care about Republican or Democrat. I wonder about the middle class. I wonder about how we, whether it's our urban communities, whether it's our rural communities, how we ensure that there is a strong, robust middle class. If we were to take your Maslow's hierarchy analogy, the middle of Maslow's hierarchy is that your physiological needs are met, your safety needs are met, and you have love and belonging. That's kind of the middle.
Yeah, exactly.
And if we think about the 19, and of course, by no means am I suggesting that the United States was perfect. By no means was it perfect, especially for African Americans in this country. But what's interesting is I think this country's strength was built on a strong middle class. And with digitization and globalization, and to your point, large factions of people in urban America and rural America who don't have even love and belonging, safety, physiological needs. I've said it on this podcast before. The town where my grandfather grew up, the state was Iowa. The town was Fort Dodge. And my grandfather worked at Hormel, a meatpacking plant. He was an electrician, didn't have a high school education. But he still could have a living wage and do well. And so how do we as a country, how do we as a globe, ensure that that middle class is robust? Because I think what's happening in a lot of those spaces is when some of those base level needs are not being met, when I have a whole community that has lost hope or has lost purpose or has lost meaning because the plant left, quote unquote, we have a lot of people who are faced with working at the prison or working at the Walmart. And that's nothing against Walmart or nothing against the prison, the people who work in those organizations. But It's a challenge. It's a major challenge. And how we prop up that strong middle class is, for me, one of the greatest challenges that we face as a country. Andrew Yang has some thoughts. I don't know if you've read.
Yeah, I know about the universal income stuff and so forth. I mean, for me, you used a term that I think has way more in it than a lot of people see, and that is the term community. And I know that may sound harsh, and normally I wouldn't want to go there, but I think these times sometimes really require to take a position. I think if somebody were to ask me, Axel, you've been here 25 years, what have you seen on the big picture, which I'm always priding myself, and this is also something that a PhD in leadership helps you to develop, on the big picture, what have you seen in those 25 years? And I believe you could argue in two ways, but the big picture is we have lost community. And partially we have lost community because we are so much aggrandizing ourselves that we have lost the ability and willingness to look beyond our own borders, right? I mean, I give you one example. China is building about between 1,000 and 5,000 miles a year in fast train. Really fast, like 150-mile, 200-mile fast train. And we are chuckling about an Amtrak somewhere in the New York area that can go in little stretches up to 100 miles. But when you look at the scale, the countries are about the same size. The difference is four times as many people. But for 30 years, they have developed fast train as one little example. And they have more than 10,000 miles of fast train now. It's not an overnight thing, but why? Because there's pride in the whole population as a community accomplishing things together. And you can argue the system. I'm not saying their system is better or should be adopted or anything. But when I'm looking at my last 25 years, really, literally, I came here at the year the Denver airport was open. And you tell me any other large airport that has been opened in the last 25 years, and you know that Beijing has two new airports in the same time frame. They built one for the Olympics in 2008, and they just finished one in 2019. And they're both the size of the Denver airport. So airports, transportation, infrastructure, bridges, streets, and stuff like that. So it's when we're talking to how do we have a middle class, then you need to also ask yourself, can everybody work from home in a digital environment and just provide services? And I argue, no, if you really want to have a community, the community needs to provide and constantly evolve. And evolution means new ways of transport, new ways of creating energy, building solar farms and wind farms and changing from coal. And that doesn't mean that you discard one set of people and bring in another set of people. You just need to improve skills. When it was maybe like you said, your grandfather didn't need a high school education. Well, we have to acknowledge that might not be possible. But what cannot be the case is that when you and I are grandfathers, we are still getting $7.75 as a wage to do a job. That can't be the case. And when people say, okay, what I mean by looking beyond our borders, we are very quick from our elevated perch that we believe we are standing on, which I'm not so sure anymore, that what people in Europe do, what people in Asia do, what people in Africa or South America do is not relevant. And that goes to natural catastrophes, right? When we have a flood, guess what? Shouldn't we ask the Dutch how they have been handling flood for the last 500 years? 80% of their country is below sea level. But going to ask somebody is also humble yourself a little bit. Right. And when you constantly being fed the diet that you are somewhere on the city on the hill with a picket fence and you're something, the superior nation and stuff like that, then this willingness to say, well, maybe there are other people who can teach us something where we don't have to go through the learning curve. Every time any person is exposed to something new, personally, we are immediately willing to say, oh, yeah, there's a learning curve until I get to some level of mastery. But on the national level or on the country level, I would say in the last 25 years, to bring this back to the original question, that has basically been abandoned. We're just telling ourselves stuff. We're not really doing much. We're constantly, you know, regurgitating things and attributes and accolades. But when you really say, give me an example, something that is really a good example where from, let's say, 1995, we really made massive progress. And what people throw up is always, okay, we came up with Google and stuff like that and all these digital things. And that's true. But that's not all. You can't eat Google or Yahoo or LinkedIn or social media or anything like that. Right? And while others have adopted that too, they have kept developing their way of doing business, their philosophies, their politics, their country, their systems, their healthcare, and on and on and on, right? And we are still fighting if should healthcare be a human right. And I agree with you, Andrew Yang. I'm not sure if I go as far as universal income, but I can say even in Germany, they came up with a version of that by saying, okay, when you retire, there should be a minimum universal support financially. Right, because if you go by a system that only pays you based on how much you put in, like Social Security, well, if for whatever circumstances you couldn't put in a lot, and last year, 2020, is probably one of the years where a lot of people couldn't put in a lot, why would you get punished 20 years later when you retire? So they basically said, okay, we don't want to do universal income, but what we want to do is make sure that our community, those who have provided input into the system for their whole work life, are assured to have a living wage or have a living retirement, basically. Right? And that's one variation on Andrew Yang's idea, but I think it goes back to the core term community. If we see ourselves as a community, then there shouldn't be a question that the weaker ones get support from the stronger ones. I'm blown away that here we are, for me, 25 years after I came here, and that is not accepted. That's not an accepted standard. And as long as we are fighting this and claiming that we have another way, right, it's almost like if you go to the animal kingdom to say, have you ever seen a tribe where they're sitting on two sides and fighting with each other all the time? They might do that when they have everything under control, but as soon as there's any threat from the outside, they all huddle together and turn around and defend the tribe. And we are arguing that only privileged people in our society are allowed for certain things if they paid for it. Yeah. And it's just not a modern way to do things anymore. And everybody else has seen that.
It's not sustainable.
Yeah, it's not sustainable. Exactly. You're totally right. And so everybody else has seen it. But when you say, oh, no, no, we're living on this island, right? And to the north, there's only the North Pole. So it's really an island capped off by Canada. So then we don't need to look what happens across the Atlantic or across the Pacific. Or we look at it only from a military perspective to say there are all the evildoers who want something from us and we need to be armed to the teeth, $760 billion a year, every year, year after year, right? And if you ask yourself, if we were, and I'm saying this as a retired military officer at a pretty good rank level, I don't think any country needs to spend $700+ billion a year to perceived and to prepare for perceived enemies. When we have the situation internally that we have, that we see in every walk of life, right?
This
is a little bit of a rant in that direction, but the big picture thing is community and providing that mid-level on the hierarchy that you pointed out, that automatically then also leads to that mid-level in income, that mid-level of standing in society, that ability to support your family and your community. Also, to have the ability to reflect. If you're running the rat race 50 hours a week with two minimum wage jobs, you have no time to reflect.
Exactly, exactly. And it's difficult for me to even visualize self-actualization or love and belonging if really those base level necessities. And so again, we have a faction of people in the United States who systematically have been denied some of that. And we have a faction of the United States who has in more recent times lost a lot of that.
Yeah.
And both factions are in a different version of trauma, but in a very similar space. And how we get millions of people back into that middle space where there's hope, there's purpose, there is, to your point, and back to Maslow, there's love, there's belongingness.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's, again, I don't care Republican, Democrat. It's, I think what we are seeing right now is symptoms of an unhealthy system that to your point is 200+ years old, needs some work, needs some updating. And you're exactly right. I believe it's China that's just started introducing artificial intelligence courses in AI in high school.
What fascinates me, and it's not just China, is where you have a particular motivation with a goal in mind. Right. And if I had to say what fill in the blanks, what is that for us right now? It's individualism.
Yeah.
And the goal is profit motive. How can I maximize my profit as an individual? And some people are awesome at it and they go totally to the moon, Elon being one of them, or Jeff Bezos and people like that. But the vast majority cannot, in my view, flourish with a purely a profit motive. There are many, many other things. And when you go to these things like self-actualization or love or security and stuff, it has nothing to do with profit. It has nothing to do with financials. It has a lot to do with reflection, but you can't do that if you're struggling every day to make a little more profit. And it starts with something like, why does every company that is publicly listed have to report advancement every 90 days? Any person in Asia looks at us and says, are you nuts? Are you seriously telling me that a company that's in business for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and the biggest ones are about, like Microsoft is now 30, and every 90 days they actually fooled you to believe that they made a progress?
Yeah.
I mean, think about your own life. Who is actually able to say every 90 days I can report out how much better I got? I mean, that's kind of like how, and we ask people, not just companies, we now ask individuals. Tell me how much better you have gotten. And at some point, you just wear people out, literally. And then they shut down. And we're now at the thing to say it's easier to just basically join a cult left or right and just do that if I'm asked for something. And the rest of the thing, I'm just trying to survive.
Well, as I'm thinking out loud now, as I kind of reflect on the conversation, because we need to wind down. We've been going for
30 minutes. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. I love it. It's been wonderful. But at least a few things that come to mind for me are, you know, do we as a country, do we have some shared understanding of some norms? Do we have a community and a sense of community where there is concern for all and ensuring that all are at a certain level and have some of their base level needs met? And do we have purpose and do we have vision and do we have an exciting future ahead? Are we hungry? Are we innovating? Are we creating? And is there, again, think about what it feels like to work in SpaceX right now. Just people facilitating interstellar travel? Sure. Yeah, let's go. I mean, it's life-giving, just even what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. The one thing, the term that when I reflect about this and what you just said and what we discussed, the real, for me, most important term is accountability. Right. I mean, we just went through this election cycle and I originally told myself I'm not going to listen in too much. I listened like maybe 2% of what I used to do.
Sure.
But if we keep doing on every level, whether it's state level, governorships, senators, Congress people, all the way up to the top, if you listen to just a few of those things, and I'm always saying lately, can I please get permission to hold you accountable for the things that you're saying? If you just imagine that, go through the last few election cycles, listen to some of the things on YouTube and say, if you were the accountability czar of the United States and you had permission every time, you could say, I give you like the famous 90 days to show that you at least took the first step to do any of those things that you said you promised you would do. Because the thing is, whether it's Tesla or SpaceX or General Motors or Google or stuff like the people working there in any company, actually, they are constantly held accountable to do what they promised their boss, their manager, their supervisor to do.
Yeah.
And the people that we say, because we don't all have individually time to run the whole country, so we pick people on all kinds of different levels to do the job for us. Zero accountability. Every year is for 25 years I've been living here. I've listened to these, all the things that are going to happen from every single person. It gets more poetic the higher the position, right? But when you say, freaking, where is the accountability? And as long as we don't do that, I really predict that. If we let people be elected, and to me, right, like you have a 12% approval rating for Congress and an 80% re-election for the incumbent. To me, if I would really be brutal, and I think you want to cut this out, only idiots do this, to say, I hate what they do, but I re-elect them because I don't want to reflect who I'm actually talking about. 80% incumbent re-election rate. It's just...
Can I keep that in, Axel? Are you comfortable with me keeping
it? You can keep it in. I'm just saying that's accountability. Okay. We're all joking about Einstein, right? Like, but what we're doing is insanity. We keep doing the same mistake over and over and over again and expect different results. We're being told every 4 years promises and statements. Nobody is holding people to account. And then we are surprised 4 years later. Oh, they're saying the same thing. Obviously, they didn't get the shit done that they promised last time. And over and over and over and over again. And that's the problem in my view. I mean, you cannot have a vision. Like any company, you're a leadership aficionado. We always say you have to have goals, you have to have strategies, you have to have a vision. Well, how is it that we can't have a vision where we really can all unite behind, close the trench and move forward? Kennedy said we need to be on the moon in less than 10 years from now. Right now, you would probably have a divided country to say, is Elon Musk sane or is he nuts?
Yeah.
Right. That's just one example. And you can go to all kinds of other people that have visions. Right. Look at how much we're vilifying Jeff Bezos for his money. Nobody praises him for having this awesome vision to take a little thing like a book store and make Amazon out of it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's the other thing. I know we need to close here, but one thing that actually fascinated me to come to the United States was to have the opportunity to have an idea and run with it and really do something with it and have a pretty good chance to be successful. And that idea part, that creative part, is being basically sacrificed at the altar of profit. And if somebody is ultimately successful and profitable, we basically vilify them. We counting them. We're sending letters and emails and tweets to Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos to say, you have so many billions. Here are all the social things you should do. Instead of being accountable to say, I must have elected the wrong person because it's not Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos' job to do the social things. That's what the politicians we elected for have been elected. And over and over and over, they don't deliver. They only tell us every 4 years what they want to do, but they never deliver. And now we turn around and say, let me tweet to Elon. It's not his job, right? But if we don't hold ourselves and the people we elect on our behalf accountable, we can't expect different results.
Well, it makes me think of the quote, every system's perfectly designed for the results that it achieves.
Exactly.
And our system has some results right now that are not healthy. It's as if we're running Microsoft DOS, and that's, you know, there's some fundamentals there.
A system has its time too, right? Like when the Microsoft DOS is not just an evolution in technology, it also had its time. And I would go as far as saying the system we're running was probably okay for the 60s and 70s and the 20th century. It's not okay in the 21st century.
And what does that look like now? You're exactly right. And I think that's where we pause, as to leave listeners with that reflection. Our system right now is yielding some results that are unhealthy. There's a lack of accountability. There's a lack of purpose and direction in many of our communities. There's a lack of ensuring that individuals have some basic rights that ensure that they are in the middle, at least, of Maslow's hierarchy. And when that occurs, we get to some things that we've experienced in recent years and recent decades in many ways. When we don't address some of the core challenges that our country has faced for hundreds of years in the treatment of certain populations of people, it's a toxic soup, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would like to put a little bit more positive spin on it and say, I believe very strongly that there's enormous creativity, ideas, and ability in the population. But it can't come out when you have to fight for survival all day long. So what we should all kind of try to do our part is to enable more people, and that's what I try to do with my business, enable the team members on my team to have the ability to reflect, to be well paid so that they don't have to struggle, that they don't have to take on another role or another job and spend more time with somebody else and not have ever any time to reflect. Because when people have the ability to reflect at that mid level that you mentioned, those creative juices and creative ideas can come out, and they might come out initially just for them. And then they come for them and their friends. And then they make a business, and their business can thrive and can bring other people in and can get us maybe like Elon to Mars. But we got to get those creative juices moving, and we can get them moving when we all on our level, the level that we can actually impact and influence, when on our level we try to do the right things to enable people to have that opportunity to reflect and be creative.
Yeah. And I think it's a fascinating conversation. It really is. And I really appreciate your time today. I appreciate the conversation, Axel. I'm wondering, I have one final question for you. Is there anything you've read or listened to or been streaming that has stood out for you in recent months?
Well, it's now getting a little dated. As at some point early in the pandemic times last year, I read a book by John Sofori called The Wealthy Gardener. Now, it has a little bit to do with investing, but John wrote the book for his son to understand how do you lead a life that is supportive, that has this idea of gardening and growing something and creating something and involving people. And it can have a business component too. And it really, I really find John did a wonderful job at putting a lot of like really valuable lessons in, right? In my investing community, a lot of people say Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Poor Dad, this is a seminal book, and it definitely is, but it also has a little bit of age to it now. John probably in that same space to say, okay, how do I lead a life that leads to whatever your definition of a successful journey would be? I would recommend for people to take a look at that.
I love it. Axel, this may be the longest podcast ever. I really appreciate the conversation because it's such an important conversation, and I love having your perspective. And so thank you, sir. Thank you for the work you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope it gave a little bit of perspective of how can you take a PhD and do something with it.
I'm going to call you the reflective practitioner. Okay. Because that's what you are.
All right. Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
John. Okay. Take care. Be well.
All right. Thank you so much.
As a listener, you deserve a gold star. You made it through a pretty heavy conversation at times, a lengthy conversation at times, but there's so much in there that is so incredibly valuable. I think what I'm going to walk away with is this conversation around first principles thinking, starting with possibilities, defining and exploring a completely new path, creating a new recipe, and, you know, looking into the future and looking at future needs. We identified a number of challenges. What type of thinking, that first principles thinking, can help us chart new territory? I also loved how Axel discussed this notion of a creator mindset. And I would bet if he were here with me while reflecting now, I think that the creator mindset and first principles thinking are very, very close cousins. That's the practical wisdom for me. Thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day wherever you are in the world, and be well. You have been listening to the Practical Wisdom for Leaders podcast. If you liked what you heard, please share it with others and let them know what we're up to. And one last quick reminder to click subscribe so you know when we publish new episodes. And of course, we'd love to hear your feedback. You can stay in touch with me by visiting www.scottjallen.net or any number of social media platforms. Be well, be safe, and make a difference wherever you are on this beautiful planet. And now, here's Kate's twin sister, Emily, with the outro.
You've been listening to Phronesis, Practical Wisdom with Scott Allen.